Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University. Yale Global Online is the flagship publication of the Yale Center for the Study of Globalization. Here, Yale Global editor Nayan Chanda interviews Louis Uchitel, author of The Disposable American, Layoffs and Their Consequences. The interview was conducted May 11, 2006.
We are pleased to have in our studio Louis Uchitel, economics writer of the New York Times. He has just published a book, The Disposable American, and this book is going to be the main subject of our conversation this morning. So Uchitel, welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
First of all, the subject of your book is, of course, of great topical importance given the state of
layoffs and their consequences.
But if you tell us a little bit, how did you come up with the idea of writing this book?
Well, I've been covering economics for the Times since the late 80s, and it was almost every other story in one form or another had to do with this process of layoffs. And I sort of tracked it. We resisted them quite a bit in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, and that resistance gradually evaporated.
When you said resisted, meaning who resisted?
We as a people, people would protest the layoffs. People would, when it spread to white collar workers, for example, to the Harvard class of 58, when they realized that some of their own people were laid off in the early 90s, there was great shock. There was great effort to try to help them get back into their jobs. When some of the steel mills shut down, there was an effort on the part of a community to Campbell Works near Youngstown, Ohio, to get it for the community to take it over, put it back on its feet. President Carter came in at that time with a loan guarantee to help modernize the mill so that it could be globally competitive. That sort of reaction, that desire to save industry and jobs, gradually dissipated, I mean by acquiescence. And we got to the point where you laid off 5,000 workers, which was headlines across the country in the late 70s. It barely gets into the paper now. And we've come to accept that. We've forgot the resistance. We forgot the context. We've lost sight of the fact that there are alternatives, if not to all the layoffs, then to a lot of them.
Before we go into the question of layoff, let's first of all hear what are the conditions in the 70s or 60s that allowed the American workers a kind of job security that they don't have anymore?
Well, the job security in America, which is a very unique American thing, was quite practical. Started in the late 1800s with the rise of giant corporations, the first of the Industrial Revolution, what later became multinationals, Procter & Gamble, DuPont, Eastman Kodak, the giant railroads. Alfred Chandler at Harvard is a wonderful historian. It became quite managers realized that job security was important. These were complex organizations. They needed experienced people to run them. And so they put into place policies, the managers themselves, that preserved the jobs. Part of it was also union agitation. Procter & Gamble came up with William Procter came up with a very innovative pension plan in 1888, which happened to be a year after the Haymarket riots in Chicago. So he was worried about unrest, but he was worried about losing workers. He needed skilled people. This went on right up to the 30s, what they called it, welfare capitalism. Mm-hmm. In the 30s, of course, it began to dissipate, but we stepped in, of course, during that huge depression with laws, labor laws that strengthened it. And after the war, it was sent with a memory of the depression and the job loss and the importance of job security. Even Peter Drucker recognized it in one of his best management books. Everybody was in favor of job security, and that's
that enabled not only productivity, but a company sort of doing well.
They did well. Productivity rose.
Secure workers. Yeah.
And of course, we had hegemony. No one was competing against us. Well, along came, of course, the global competition in the form of autos from Japan and hand tools, which I illustrate in a chapter about the Stanley Works from Asia, and all sorts of products. We lost our our monopoly, if you will, and we were caught at a moment when we weren't so efficient in manufacturing. And there was a need to cut labor costs and to do a number of things. But what started out as a legitimate response to global competition went, in my opinion, or in my reporting, in all my reporting, and this is what drove me to write this book, beyond what you could justify with global competition or even good sense.
Mm-hmm. So you are writing in your book that the corporations basically look at mass layoff as the only cost-cutting measure they could adopt in order to adjust to the competition. Now, how did they get away doing this?
Well, it's very interesting. It's not just mass layoff. It's all sorts of layoffs. Part of this, of course, was they were going through a period when unions were in decline. The unions were strongest in the companies most exposed to global competition, and there was an undercurrent of resistance to unions that developed in the 80s. Part of it brought on by the unions themselves. So, and we got into the idea, which was a myth, that look, we're not efficient, but if you'll just bear with us, folks, and bear the pain of losing your job, in a few years we'll become efficient, and the layoffs will stop, and we'll reach a new equilibrium. I think what developed was that labor cost cutting in the form of layoffs became the root of least resistance and a form of capitalizing on profitability and on the stock market, which became the single measure rather than in the past when CEOs were they had the stock shareholders to worry about, but also the workers and the community and the suppliers and the customers and the society as a whole.
So this was a kind of paradigm shift.
Yes.
In terms of the company shareholders and directors caring not about workers, but caring only about the quarterly bottom line.
Yes.
And so how did this happen? This is the kind of mystery.
It's still a mystery to me as much as I've explained it, but the paradigm shift included going from a society in which we thought of ourselves as a community, if you will, everyone in it for everyone else, to this individualism, which has always been a strain in American society, which got out of hand. I think that it became very convenient to blame workers for their own layoffs. We got to the point where we said, look, we have to lay you off because you're not worth what we're paying you. Tremendous psychologically damaging blow to people. And then we said the solution is training and education, and you'll qualify for the good jobs out there. There weren't enough good jobs out there, so you're blamed again for not enough training, not moving around, not being flexible enough. Very convenient for the Republicans and the Democrats. They didn't have to come up with policies that might challenge the layoffs and challenge what was going on. Very convenient, of course, for the CEOs. They were absolved of responsibility. But we did not measure the social damage. We used to measure in this country all sorts of social damage. And we didn't measure, for example, the damage to the psychological damage from being told that you don't have value. I was amazed doing this story at the extent, doing this book. You know, a journalist does goes out and interviews somebody for a daily story or for a story that's done after a month's research, and you don't get deeply into the lives of these people until you do a book, and then you really become involved tracking families. And I only used in the book some of the people that I've got to know over the years. You realize that I never thought I would be so drawn into the psychiatric aspects of layoff. I'm not talking unemployment. Right. Unemployment is a separate issue. Mm-hmm. Just this traumatic statement that you don't have a place in society, in the workplace, in a society that where people's identity is very much wrapped up in the workplace among other forms of identity, family, community, and so forth. The workplace is very important. So here you're doing this damage. And I went to psychiatry. They said, yes, this is a real... We're undermining We run across it all the time in therapy, and we are undermining public health. In fact, mm-hmm. I'm going mm-hmm. to go and make this point to a psychiatric convention in yeah. less than a month, mm-hmm. and we're not putting a warning label on it. There's right. something wrong. Well, if we have to measure that. If we're not going to measure that, then we're not going to put some sort of brakes on layoffs. Again, I do not want to say that we can stop the layoffs, but I do think that if we measured them, the damage, we would begin to say, well, is there a way to lay off 5 people yeah. instead of 10? Are there ways to make people feel better if we lay them off? Are there social ways to deal with this problem?
One of the things that I found most interesting in your book is the fact that Democrats, starting with Jimmy Carter, seem to have adopted policies which have legitimized mm-hmm. the layoff that had begun in large scale.
Yes.
How did this happen? Why did the Carter administration go along with this?
Well, the Carter administration, they got into deregulation, which was becoming quite a public pressure at the time. That was one thing. The deregulation of the airlines, there was at one point 13% of the workforce was protected by worked in regulated industries, and regulation meant job protection. That's not to say regulation is good or shouldn't be altered, but a protection was removed. Carter also became more concerned with inflation than he did with full employment, if you will. Mm-hmm. And he became concerned that the United States had to be the buyer of last resort for the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. It entered into his decision not to go through with this loan guarantee to upgrade the technology at the Campbell Works. Right. While Europeans governments were helping their steel industry rebuild, Carter felt it was important to purchase European steel. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't that so much that the Japanese invaded our markets, but to some extent we invited them in. Mm-hmm. We were, and I can't criticize that necessarily. That was the nature of globalization. What I do criticize is that we then turned around and in the name of globalization, we got into layoffs saying we need this to compete globally. When in fact, so far as I can tell from all my research, layoffs and outsourcing are 90 or 70 or 80 or 60% a domestic affair. Mm-hmm. There aren't that many jobs yet. They're
right.
rising that have gone offshore.
Yeah, we'll come to that. But let me dig this point. You mentioned on page 14 that by the late 90s, however, the Made in America sentiment had dissipated. Americans had become focused on quality and price and uninterested in origin.
Yes.
That a product was made abroad ceased to be a negative. Now, is it realistic to think that consumers, in peacetime, would pay more attention to a patriotic concern of Made in America than about quality and price?
Well, I was just trying to make the point that one of the resistances to layoffs was this idea that Made in America was important. It was part of our national wealth, if you will. It wasn't a peace or war issue as much as it was, and it wasn't logical, but it was an issue of support our workers. So I bought a Ford car, a Taurus once. It was the last American car I bought. It was so bad that I since purchased a Nissan. But there was this label right on the front window saying Made in America by American labor.
Right.
And Walmart made a big, big advertising campaign out of how they purchased only American-made goods until CBS or one of the networks came along and just went shopping in the store and found that most of it was made abroad. Well, Walmart doesn't even think about a thing like that anymore.
Right.
Right. So on the margin, chipping away, jobs were lost. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say they were lost for a bad reason, but there was that resistance, that sense of certain things should stay home,
right.
dissipated.
The other factor you mentioned, among many things that have allowed this layoff to continue, is on page 135, you quote a business historian, Peter Capelli, saying that there had always been the issue of balancing corporate profitability with protections for employees and own communities, the shareholder value movement altered that balance.
Yes.
Now, how do you make shareholders care more about employees and community than about their portfolio value?
Well, it wasn't that you can't get shareholders to do that. But out of the Depression and out of the rise of job security in the early, before the Depression, came this sense of, we didn't want to go through those sort of traumas again, came a constituency for job security and came a constituency for community protection. Mm-hmm. The corporate culture, it was a culture. And I illustrated it with the Stanley Works. There were three chief executives, three generations of chief executives. They thought that way. They would have loved to have beaten down labor, but it wasn't socially acceptable. Unions had enough power to push back. Mm-hmm. So the issues were never over layoffs. They were always over furloughs or seniority, who might be sent home for 6 weeks until business picked up again. And that was a culture. And somehow, starting with Carter, the importance of capital, the decline of unions, the rise of options and of financial instruments, the use of stock and of bonuses to pay chief executives, and the attachment of CEO pay to performance, which was never as emphasized in the past as it is today, we shifted to a shareholder-oriented society. Kidding ourselves, and we used to talk about this all the time, we stopped doing it. We're all shareholders, so if we're not getting a salary, well, we can live off our dividends. Mm-hmm. Nobody says that anymore, but that was actually a thought mm-hmm. at one time. And it really went strongly when it was blue-collar workers, because we all could say, well, they're not worth what we're paying them. Then it shifted to white-collar workers like ourselves, and we didn't want to say that anymore. Mm-hmm. And there was a backlash in the 90s. And so there was a political moment when Bill Clinton, running for a second term, could have pushed back. And he said, in effect, I don't want class warfare. That was a phrase that one of his people used, if not himself, the opposing class being the CEOs. So he took a position that he would generate enough jobs, people could get laid off, they would get reeducated and retrained, and segue into jobs that paid as well as the ones they lost. Well, that didn't happen. But that was sort of, when he took that position, maybe the last barrier to layoffs came down.
Mm-hmm. You say that when NAFTA was signed,
yes,
there was a promise that there might be, over 10 years, there'll be a net gain of 200,000 jobs. Mm-hmm. But after 10 years, three quarters of a million to a million jobs have been lost.
Yes.
Now, can you actually clearly link this job loss to NAFTA?
I can't. And, of course, that's a huge debate. Mm-hmm. The standard is that we went from a surplus in our trade at the time of NAFTA to a deficit. And then and there's been several books written about it, and this AFL-CIO and various think tanks in Washington have argued what the number is. But I think everyone agrees that jobs have been lost, perhaps not as many as some quarters would suggest, but that there has been a job loss. The original idea that we would generate jobs by shipping capital goods to Mexico for use in producing consumer goods didn't quite work out that way.
In fact, jobs later on moved from Mexico to China.
Yes, jobs, in fact, moved from Mexico to China. This was just the beginning, and you can't just say. So in the end, it was NAFTA shifted jobs overseas. But I would still argue, mm-hmm. even with NAFTA, NAFTA became a turning point for Mr. Clinton. I would say during his first term, he took a few steps to try to stem the layoffs. He tried, for example, to declare illegal the use of replacement workers, permanent replacements for strikers. He tried to make unemployment insurance premiums on corporations higher so that it might be.
But ultimately, Congress didn't pass those bills.
Nothing. And when 96 came along And Pat Buchanan did well in the New Hampshire primary, and there was this backlash, and the New York Times was writing a downsizing series of which I was part, and Alan Sloan in Newsweek was talking about corporate killers. His response was to soothe everyone and say, we'll do it through job creation. So and so that was a big, that was sort of a, we'll live with layoffs from now on. And we didn't properly measure the layoffs. We don't know, even now we don't measure the extent of them. So he himself argued they're not as bad as you journalists are saying they are. Only now are the statistics beginning to catch up, and even then they don't catch the hidden layoffs, the forced retirements. Yeah,
because you give the number from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, 30 million jobs, manufacturing jobs lost in
the last... No, just jobs.
I see.
But I did that after many conversations with Tom Nardone, who is in charge of all this data, and I've known people at the BLS, a wonderful agency, for a long time. That 30 million is my figure. What you can deduct from the worker displacement, the biennial worker displacement survey, in which people are asked whether they had lost a job because it was abolished or for very restricted reasons, you could come up full-time workers. This is an unpublished statistic. About 100 million full-time workers in America today. Maybe 4% are laid off annually, according to that survey. Mm-hmm. Then, and this is my estimate, if you added in all the people, I mean, layoffs have shifted to a different, to a more indirect form, who accept a retirement package, mm-hmm. knowing that if they didn't, they would have a problem, or quit because they don't want to take a cut in pay, or take a buyout, thinking that if they don't, they might be forced out of the company without one. All these hidden forms of layoffs, you come up with about 7%, mm-hmm. roughly, of all full-time workers. Never mind part-time.
In what period?
Annually.
Annually, I see.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's a lot.
I see.
And that would, if we had that sort of data, people might get alarmed, because I think, I didn't think of this when I was writing the book, but I think that the main solution, quote unquote, that I offer is to inform people of what has gone on starting in the late 19th century. And when they get a sense of what's happened, what they've forgotten, maybe a discussion will start. Mm-hmm. And maybe people will say, do we have to do all this? Mm-hmm. And that, in the end, has to be the solution.
Yeah, well, I'll come back to the solution. Just one question. In your whole book, I couldn't find the word globalization once.
That's true.
And yet, it seems to me that the book illustrates one of the impacts of globalization on American economy. The examples you give of companies downsizing, laying off, they're all doing because they're facing competition from abroad. So if you were to apportion kind of responsibility for America's layoffs, what percentage of responsibility will put on global trading challenge as opposed to corporate policies, government policies, or?
Maybe you and I would disagree on this, but I would put less of an emphasis on globalization than I would on corporate policies. They both, of course, play a role. I'm not going to even begin to suggest that we should keep the shoe industry or the textile industry in America or other labor-intensive industries. But there are cases where on the margin, and the margin is where the solution is, we've gone too far. The Stanley Works, for example, makes tape measures.
Now, Stanley Works is a company that produced hand tools, right?
Hand tools. Yeah. So Stanley Works is based in New Britain, Connecticut, and produces hand tools. One of its most famous is this tape measure that spools out of a cassette that you hook to your belt. They once made all the domestic supply in the United States. They made an effort, and I was just talking to the CEO the other day who was in this book, Richard Ayers, to automate their main plant in New Britain. And they did automate. They automated badly, and they should have gone back at it again. And they still keep a certain amount of the production here. But they had put a plant in Thailand, where they intended originally to make these tape measures for the foreign market. They then decided, the third CEO who came in, the heck with that, we'll make them and ship them back to the United States, a lot of them. And that'll put a lot of pressure on labor in our plants that remain in America. I would question whether that was necessary or whether a lot of that tape measure production could have been kept here with automation. That's not the same thing as keeping the workers, because the automation might have cost the jobs anyway. But there would have been the production here, the spin-off industries, and a sense that we're trying to keep people here. So that, with other policies of helping people, might have at least taken some of the stigma out of layoffs. I have another example of the United Airlines Maintenance Center in Indianapolis. There was it was a brilliantly executed maintenance center, probably one of the finest in the world for narrow-body jets, that is the 737s, the A319s, and so forth. And it was built in the early 90s, and for a while, until a labor dispute erupted, and before 2001, they were doing, the FAA requires that these jets be stripped down, dismantled, and rebuilt every 5 years. They were doing that in 10 days or 11 days instead of 20 days. It was so, and then that extra revenue from the extra time in the air paid the relatively high wages of the mechanics and of the operation of the center. It was so efficient that Lufthansa was thinking about bringing globalization here, its planes here. It was a winner in the global battlefield. Well, this labor dispute developed. Far be it from all sides were at fault, as far as I could see, and 9/11 just complicated the matter. What eventually, there was a slowdown. United dealt with it by outsourcing. This was before 9/11. And it continued to outsource, and it eventually shut down that center. Now, because it was
outsourced to some other place in the United States.
In the United States.
Right.
It might someday, that outsourcing might go overseas, but so far it's in the South in the United States. Well, 20 or 30 years ago, and this was with the, even though they didn't even own the center, the Indianapolis government did, Indiana and Indianapolis government. 20 or 30 years ago, outsourcing didn't exist. Mm-hmm. The company would have been forced to make some agreement with labor, and layoffs would have been socially unacceptable for an airline, or more so than they are today. And so there would have been an agreement of some sort. Labor, in fact, was trying, after being cantankerous and difficult, seeing what was happening, the unions were trying to we're giving in right and left. Mm-hmm. The company said, the heck with it. We're just not going to expose ourselves to this sort of trouble again. And I'm oversimplifying the story. And when I asked them about it, they said it was, sure, the efficiency pays off, but so does really cheap labor down south. Yes. So the irony was that some of these mechanics who got laid off in Indianapolis at earning $30 an hour are now, went to work at some of the outsourcers for $17 an hour.
And there is no labor union there in the South?
There are some labor unions. The labor unions put up with that. The labor unions are no longer a barrier to $17 an hour. Mm-hmm. And so you've lost, that center is virtually not operating. It's got some of the bays are rented out. And so you've lost this jewel. There's a lot of mechanics. Some of them ended up, one of them I tracked for a while, ended up running a water taxi for
someone
tourists.
Was running trucks and driving trucks.
All this wonderful talent and skill lost, wasted, mm-hmm. not to mention the psychological damage. So mm-hmm. in that sense, it's not global. It is globalization, but it's not globalization.
It was policy.
Yeah, it's a policy thing. Mm-hmm. And if you want to talk globalization, we could have won that battle. Mm-hmm. And all I can't give you a silver bullet overriding solution, but if you take it case by case and say, look, folks, globalization is a factor, and we are losing jobs to globalization, and it does make it a lot easier to undercut unions here. But we will try, as a people, to limit the damage. Mm-hmm. And that's about all you can do in this day and age.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you have basically talked about blue-collar workers.
Yes.
Now,
and white-collar workers in one chapter.
Right. White-collar jobs are now more at risk because of outsourcing, because of the electronic highway that mm-hmm. takes jobs away. Have you looked at that aspect of?
Well, as a reporter, and there is a footnote in this book, so far, and I've been over this with a number of people who try to collect these figures, and it's very hard to find, but so far there's probably fewer than a million jobs that have been lost to this sort of offshoring. Mm-hmm. It's not a big number yet.
Yeah.
Most of the white-collar work is being lost right here in America as a means of cost-cutting.
And automation. Right.
And just simply, we don't want to bear this cost. Mm-hmm. That's partly an indirect result of the competition from abroad. But in the auto industry, Toyota and Honda are paying wages almost as good as what a lot of UAW workers are earning. They don't have the legacy costs for health care, and they're doing quite mm-hmm. you know, it's not so much a wage issue in a lot of industries as it is a behavioral issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what I have to sort out every time globalization comes up, what is truly global competition
mm-hmm.
and what is something here? Now, you go to Whirlpool. This isn't in the book, and they say, look, we have lots of factories in America, but we also make our microwaves in China because we want a global platform there, and we make high-end front-loading washing machines in Germany, and we're going to make lower-end front-loading washing machines in Mexico because we don't want to concentrate too much in this country. We want a global platform. Well, that's fine for Whirlpool. It's a fine, wonderful country, but there has to be some recognition of what are the national needs of a nation and what are the corporate needs, and we've lost that debate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, coming to your solutions chapter.
Yeah.
So if you could sum up the main points, what are the solutions for this problem?
Well, if I could have written this book without a solutions chapter, I would have been very happy. I mean, my main solution is to make people aware of what's happening to them. And one of the chapters I dealt with made the point that companies that engage in layoffs often don't do as well on the stock market or in profits as companies that do engage in layoffs. I mean, in fact, there's a lot of evidence that
so
job security...
So ultimately it's in vain. They're cutting costs.
In vain, yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, Harley-Davidson, for example, had this terrible situation where back in the 80s they were saved only because Reagan put import quotas on motorcycles, and they reorganized and they got back into business. And then they made a deal with their unions that they would, every time there was an issue, the unions would have a chance to pass judgment on it. It was in debate. And I went out there once and did a story about them. And you could sit for an hour and a half and listen to the unions complain about how they're always getting the losing end of every cost-cutting deal. But the truth of the matter is that over the last decade, almost no one has been laid off at that company. There have been compromises of all sorts that have been made. So my solutions are, first of all, count the house right. And there are people like Henry Farber and others who would like to have a survey of displaced workers. Henry Farber is a Princeton University labor economist who's quite expert in this area, and others, a survey that captures the hidden layoffs, because these are no longer the old style blue collar, you know, factory type of layoffs, the forced retirement and so forth that hit so many white collar workers. That would be very important because we would then have a better statistical sense of what's happening to ourselves. I also think it would be a good idea if we required what amounts to environmental impact statements for companies, except in this case it would be every company every year listing all the people who depart from the company and how they departed, quit, retired, laid off, whatever the reasons. Mm-hmm. And then academics such as yourself would put together a database. And if the average layoffs for the airline industry was 100 a month, and here's an airline with 125, you'd say, well, why 125? Why? How come the average in a global economy is 100? Why are you beyond the average? That would have an inhibiting effect. It certainly would be a source of debate.
So shaming by statistics.
Yeah, shaming by statistics would be a wonderful start to this debate. I also raise, and I don't have a solution for this, but it's part of the debate, and it's been in the debate in America for a long time. And there's the question of whether the private sector by itself, with the best will in the world, can generate enough jobs, good jobs, a decent pay to meet the demand for them. And so far that is not happening. So this issue came up in the debate over the Employment Act of 1946 when there was real concern about another depression and whether the government should become the employer of last resort. It was, we're not a nation that goes easily to a sort of public investment economic activity. And I'm not talking Keynesian stimulus, I'm talking, and then it came up again in the mid-70s during a severe recession, the start of the debate, the first draft for the Humphrey Hawkins Act of 78, Augustus Hawkins, a black congressman from Watts, which had the endless unemployment, wanted to write into the act and did write into the early drafts of the act, making the government the employer of last resort, the source of jobs, of good jobs, if and when the private sector couldn't do it. Well, Humphrey might have picked up that idea, but he died of cancer, and Carter came in, and Carter wasn't interested. Carter was more concerned about inflation and about...
But the Reagan administration did try at one stage to put some money in micro and chip design.
Yes, there was a Semitech, and yes, there were a number. I remember this is another reason I wrote the book. One of my early stories was the Semitech effort, where companies came together to put money into chip design to become.
But it didn't pan out.
And it didn't pan out. It worked for a while. There was federal money. It was very controversial. And that barrier to layoff, so to speak, came down. Mm-hmm. And I was up, mm-hmm. Joe Bowers at Harvard Business School was one of the big forces behind that. There was big conferences about it. You have to go back into the archives to even find out about it now. Yeah there were all these possible ways to throw sand into the job loss, you know, to delay, and that process of delaying, that sense of the country trying to preserve things, I think is a healthy thing.
He also mentioned one of the solutions that the workers' right to organize in other countries should be part of a trade negotiation. That has been tried, as you know, that Clinton actually raised that during the Seattle meeting, and it was, got a huge thumbs down from other countries. Now, is it realistic that countries which are just coming out of, becoming independent or really developing countries to have the same labor standard as the developed countries?
I don't think so. But what frightens me is that the developed countries, this country at least, has lowered its labor standard rather than trying to push at the labor standards of other countries. Clinton did not, except for the Jordanian treaty, trade agreement, did not write into his agreements labor standards or environmental standards. So in a sense, we aren't engaged in free trade if you think of lower standards as a form of barrier, or Intel's president at one point, and I think I quote him in my book, The Layoffs and Their Consequences, the disposable American, said, look, why should I put a factory in America when I can go to some other country? I think he was thinking of Ireland and save $1 billion on taxes. Mm-hmm. Well, why should he? So there should be trade agreements that in one form or another neutralize taxes. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's not free trade. Mm-hmm. The tax breaks become a form of tariff, if you will. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, these are all issues that should be back on the table all the time. And if they were, we might be no better off than we are today. But I think spiritually, we would go from a sense of not even trying to preserve people, of throwing people away and telling them it's their own fault, mm-hmm. which is the biggest point I have to make in this book, to say, no, you're valuable. We don't know if we can actually save your job, but we're going to try.
So making people aware of the problem is the first step, and which you have taken. And thank you very much for your book and for coming to our studio.
Thank you for asking me, and thank you for your questions.
For more coverage of globalization issues, interviews, and articles, please go to yaleglobal.yale.edu.